is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, it's Wednesday, and a big Wednesday it is. A lot to cover today. We'll get to the election results in New York in just a minute. But first, we're going to start with the latest on the fiasco with the Flint water, because Attorney General Bill Schuette expected to charge three government officials in that Flint water crisis a little bit later today. The Attorney General will announce criminal charges against two state regulators and a Flint employee, we are now told, alleging the wrongdoing related to the city's lead-tainted water crisis. That, according to inside sources familiar with the investigation, the charges now were first levied in a probe that is expected to broaden. It will be filed against a pair of State Department of Environmental Quality officials and a local water treatment plant supervisor. Two officials told the Associated Press late yesterday they spoke on the condition that their names be withheld because they were not authorized to talk about this. The felony, did you hear that? The felony and misdemeanor charges include violating Michigan's drinking water laws, official misconduct, destruction of utility property, and evidence of tampering. I have told you from very early on that when they threw the switch, when they changed the source from the Detroit water supply to the Flint River, the moment that happened at the local municipality, at the local water supply center, if you will, in Flint, laws were being violated. Because no anti-corrosives had ever been put in the water, which is required by federal law. No written plan was in place, also required by federal law when conducting a municipal water system of this type, because water quality and water supplies vary greatly across the country, so there are uniform standards of how you approach these things. So what happened in Flint doesn't happen. The city now been in a state of emergency for more than 4 months. People there using filters and bottled water. And speaking of which, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, not impressed with Governor Snyder's pledge to drink filtered water from the city for the next 30 days. At a conference, press conference yesterday, Weaver had another idea for the governor if he really wants to know what it's like to deal with the water situation in her city. It's clip three. Go.
He needs to come and stay here for 30 days and live with us and see what it's like to have to use bottled or filtered water when you want to cook and when you want to drink and when you want to brush your teeth. That's what he needs to see.
If you didn't hear her very clearly, she says he needs to come here and live. See how difficult it is using bottled water every time you want to cook or have a drink or brush your teeth or do much of anything. Remember, the CDC and World Health Organization and others say there is no concern in bathing in lead-contaminated water. I might think twice about it, but there is no danger because they say the lead, there's not absorption through the skin when it comes to lead. So we will keep an eye, of course, on what Attorney General Bill Schuette does. This will be pretty important. We'll have all complete coverage and analysis on that on tomorrow's program. Meanwhile, Donald Trump dominates in New York, as does Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders not impressed, though, saying that 3 million people that voted registered as independents were turned away from the polls. There was a lot of chaos in New York yesterday, but record-setting numbers for the Republicans again. Donald Trump runs away with nearly 61% of the vote. Right now, it looks like he got all but all but three delegates there. I thought that he had them all at one point, but it looks like John Kasich will get three. Three delegates. So the frat boy that just doesn't know when to go home will get three delegates as a, you know, to go with whatever meaningless amount he has currently, which isn't many. Speaking of Donald Trump, let's go ahead. He says this race is over. He may be right, but heading to the convention, it's still a tight fit for him to get the 1,237 delegates to guarantee him the nomination on the Republican side. It's clip five. Go.
We don't have much of a race anymore, based on what I'm seeing on television. Senator Cruz is just about mathematically eliminated. And we've won another state. As you know, we have won millions of more votes than Senator Cruz, millions and millions of more votes than Governor Kasich. We've won, and now, and especially after tonight, close to 300 delegates more than Senator Cruz. We're really, really rocking. We expect we're going to have an amazing number of weeks because these are places and they're in trouble. They're in big trouble. When you look at Pennsylvania, when you look at Indiana, when you look at Maryland and Rhode Island and so many places, we have problems everywhere you look. We are going to solve those problems. And one of the big problems, one of the big problems is the economy and jobs, and that is my wheelhouse. So, again, I want to thank everybody. It's really nice to win the delegates with the votes. You know, it's really nice.
All right, we'll leave it there. The big problem for Donald Trump in New York, or for any Republican for that matter, is that Republicans had about half as many voters in the primary yesterday as the Democrats did. Hillary Clinton ran away with it yesterday, like I said, picking up 177 delegates on her way to securing the nomination. Bernie Sanders picking up just 105 delegates and 42% of the vote to Hillary's 58%. So a tough climb for Bernie leaving New York. But he says, again, Bernie Sanders saying that the system is not, well, the system's not right. And so there's a lot of conversation these days about the system being rigged, if you will. But here's something else I just noticed again. Donald Trump referring to Ted Cruz as Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz, not lying Ted. Not lying Ted. By the way, he's also seeming to, he's trying something different. Crooked Hillary. Crooked Hillary seems to be his new a moniker for Hillary Clinton. He's trying that on for size. Donald Trump is out there on the campaign trail. I mean, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are probably the two most disliked candidates maybe in American history when it comes to presidential frontrunners and likely nominees. She's disliked by, what, 55 or 58% of the people. Donald Trump by about 60% of the people. I mean, together, these two, they wouldn't win many friends, but they're going to win an election. I think one of them is going to be president of the United States. Which one? Who knows? We're a long way from there. Wednesday on the Steve Gruber Show.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
When the forest burns along the road, like God's eyes in my headlights.
Welcome back to it, my friends.
When the dogs are looking for their...
It's Wednesday. You know, one other thing I wanted to mention that just seems kind of obvious to me, and maybe you've seen, I wrote this article a year ago, maybe, that it looked like to me that Bill Clinton would smile and nod and say whatever, but I don't think he really wants Hillary Clinton to be president. And you say, now, come on, why would that be? Well, come on, at Thanksgiving dinner, there can only be one president. You know, I think that it would take some of the shine off from him, some of the glow, some of the, you know, accolades, him being the favorite son of the Democratic Party and all this and that makes you wonder. And when he stumbles about on the campaign trail, whew, talk about a loose cannon. You never know what's going to go on with that guy. And you wonder, is he an asset or a liability to Hillary's campaign? So there you go. Our next guest, Randall John Meyer, legal associate at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies. And shifting gear a little bit here, Randall, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And you write that President Obama just gave police the okay to simply take your stuff. Come on. What do you mean by that?
Well, as part of the 1984 Comprehensive Crime Act, Congress passed a law saying that assets that are civilly held by individuals can be forfeited to the police if the police think that there's any reason that or any possible criminality that's going on with that property and the person who potentially owns it. So essentially what this law does is it allows police to seize property without any probable cause or without proving any guilt or even issuing a citation or a ticket, and then the police can keep that and puts owners in a position where they have to prove their property is innocent of any wrongdoing.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of conversations about that here in Michigan. There's been a lot of pushback, and in fact, laws are changing in Michigan because of some high-profile cases where property was confiscated when it otherwise should not have been. And trust me, I'm going to get my text messages are going to start blowing up here any second from my good friends in law enforcement telling me I'm on the wrong side of this thing, because I've argued for a long time, if you can't prove a crime has been committed, why should you be entitled to somebody's property? And they say, now listen, if we pull somebody over on the highway that's out of state and they're driving an old car and it's got $500,000 in cash in it, we're pretty sure that they're committing a crime. And I'm like, well, what crime? Is it a crime to carry cash? No, it's not a crime to carry cash, but we're pretty sure they're going to commit a crime. And one friend of mine, we go round and round on this, but forfeiture has become a hot button issue, I think it's safe to say.
Oh, for sure. In the last 15 years, I don't usually like to use numbers, but in the last 15 years, there's been more than 1,000% increase in the total amount of assets seized by police. So in the last 15 years, what we've seen basically is this law that was passed in the 1980s to combat high-level drug traffickers is now being used at traffic stops and being used against the lowest-income residents in the city. In Philadelphia last year, more than half of the seizures were for less than the sum of $200. Now, it's going to cost more than $200 to try to get that money back through all the processes that exist for civil forfeiture.
Right.
So most people end up just accepting it.
They throw their hands up and they give up. They capitulate.
Exactly, because think about that. If you cost a lawyer $300 an hour just for 1 hour of the whole litigation, why would you pay that for $200 to get it back?
And most people that are at the lower income levels, I believe, find themselves to feel powerless against police and government for the most part anyway. I mean, let's be honest, in order to get justice, sometimes you have to hire a lawyer. Lawyers cost money, like you just said, and there you go.
Exactly.
See, and see here, and here come my text messages. I told you, so predictable.
Got any good ones?
Well, I can't repeat this one on the air. So, yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, it's not bad. So, okay, how do we make it? Because here's the thing. Forfeiture, if you're in a criminal activity, if you're involved with drug trafficking or you're stealing automobiles and parting them out, whatever it may be, and you're involved with these processes, and forfeiture probably is an appropriate approach. If you're using your house as a meth lab, you probably ought to forfeit your house when the police come in and seize your assets and so forth. But there has to be some place where people can be more, I don't know, satisfied, more believing that justice is being served and served fairly.
Oh, sure. There's a lot of different methods that can be used to reform this program. Many states, including Michigan, have enacted reform on their own levels. But the problem is the federal law kind of sets a lower bar, and oftentimes state police use the federal law instead of the state law in order to avoid all those cumbersome restrictions and get the less restrictive federal law. So really, to fix civil asset forfeiture, you need states to raise their rules, making it more difficult for police to just take cash off of individuals who are driving around with a lot of money, and to actually have to prove that someone's like a high-level drug trafficker before they take the asset. And it needs to also happen on the federal level so that the federal government stops undermining states' autonomy and their ability to control their own police forces.
So what about taking cash like that? I mean, if the state police in Michigan pull over a car and it's on I-94 and it's a known drug corridor, which it is, and they pull over a guy from out of state who has a couple of $100,000, and he says, well, I'm on my way to my aunt's house to buy a car, and they know damn well that's not what he's up to, is it appropriate to take the money?
I don't think it is without something a little bit more in evidence, but at least there's a more reasonable argument there, because as you prefaced, this is someone who's involved in drug trafficking, or at least has a stronger history of being involved.
Appears to. The person could have no history at all, but they're in a known drug area and a known drug pipeline, and they've got a bunch of cash, and you know, common sense would dictate there's something going on. I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word on how we make things better.
Well, we can make things better by paying more attention, being more careful, and enacting more legislation in order to try to stop this practice and really halt it.
All right. Well, I greatly appreciate you taking the time and being with us here, Randall. Randall John Meyer here with us today. I appreciate your time, and we'll talk soon, because the forfeiture laws, they really do get people fired up on both sides, and we'll talk more about it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
It's Wednesday. It's the Steve Gruber Show.
Michigan, born and raised with Midwestern values and Michigan common sense.
I couldn't help it. It's 33 after on a Wednesday. 33 after. America is in the middle of this energy renaissance, unlike anything the world has ever seen. I mean, let me take you back to Jimmy Carter wearing sweater vests, which, you know, that should have been a crime in of itself, in the 1970s, talking about the American malaise, and we should turn our thermostats down a couple of degrees because the world was going to run out of oil in a few years, and we would be, well, we'd be screwed, basically. Oil was going to run out, pollution was going to increase, particulate matter in the atmosphere was going to block out the sun, and 250 million people a year were going to starve to death. That's what we were told in 1970 on the first Earth Day. Well, I just checked. Sun's out. Grass is green. Crops are growing in the field at a better rate than they have in my entire lifetime. And as far as the 7 billion people on the planet, we're feeding them more efficiently than we fed half that many years ago. You see, we're pretty smart and we can create all sorts of great things. And here in America, one of the things we have created, despite the many roadblocks put up by the Obama administration and Democrats and so-called green movement people, we have created this energy renaissance using fracking and horizontal drilling. We have tapped into the largest natural gas reserve in the world. You see, what America has, more than any other single piece of real estate in the world, is natural resources. We have timber, we have farmland, we have oil and coal and natural gas, and lots of it. It's a spectacular piece of real estate. Steve Moore is with FreedomWorks. He's the senior economic contributor there. He's joining me on the program to get the real story that fracking and natural gas not only is a great renaissance for America's economy, it's also good for the environment. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. And by the way, you really nailed it with that soliloquy. I mean, you're exactly right. We are the natural resources-rich country in the world, and no other country, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Russia or China or India, has the abundance of resources that we have in this great country of ours. And I estimate, by the way, the value of just the oil and gas that we have under federal lands is $50 trillion. That's 50 trillion with a T. And we ought to be using those resources to build our economy.
There's no question. But instead, what the Obama administration has done most recently, banning all drilling in the Atlantic Ocean, which probably isn't that important, the Green River formation that I think sits under Colorado, part of Idaho, that part of the western United States, has something on the order of 4 trillion recoverable barrels of oil and natural gas, more than you could ever, you know, contemplate. In fact, the idea of peak oil that used to be thrown around in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, well, at some point there'll be a, whether you'll max out and then you'll be on the decline and then it'll all be gone. Fact of the matter is, we keep finding more. And now some scientists wonder if it isn't being perpetually produced over time and therefore we couldn't possibly exhaust the amount that we have. I mean, if you extracted 4 trillion barrels of energy from the Green River Formation, which is under federal ground, we'll get to that problem in a minute, that would supply not only our country but the world for years to come, because that one formation contains more energy than all the world oil reserves combined. Am I right?
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And, you know, we can be the energy-dominant country in the world within 5 years. So, in other words, not only will we be energy independent, but we will be exporting our natural gas, our oil. And by the way, let's not forget our coal. You know, we have 500 years worth of coal in this country. You know, the Obama administration is basically on a jihad to shut down our coal industry. You know, that's hundreds of thousands of workers, you know, oftentimes second, third generation coal mining families. They're being thrown out on the street.
But I have good news. I have really good news. Well, I have real good news here. If the Obama administration and the greenies, the fascist green movement would listen, MIT, you probably already know this, has found a process by which there is a gasification of coal that produces more energy. The coal is not burned, therefore. That comes off the coal, the CO2 and other things that are alleged greenhouse gases don't come off much at all. You create more energy, less exhaust or pollution of any sort, and that coal, that gasification of coal, could supply us for centuries.
You're right. And you know, we, by the way, you mentioned another good point, which is that if you look at the emissions from coal plants today versus 40 years ago, you know, we reduced lead, we've reduced sulfur, we've reduced carbon monoxide. Every major pollution is down 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, even 90% from where we were 40 years ago. So clean coal is here. You know, the climate change people say, well, what about carbon dioxide? Carbon dioxide is not a pollution. Carbon monoxide is a pollution. You can get sick from, you can die from carbon monoxide.
Well, I always wondered about that. Maybe, Steve, you can explain that. We are with Steve Moore, FreedomWorks Senior Economic Contributor. Yeah, when did carbon dioxide become a poisonous gas? Because that's what the greenies would like you to think, that somehow carbon dioxide, which we exhale and plants inhale, if you will, aspirate in, is somehow bad. And in fact, they have found with this increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not only are forests healthier, they're growing faster and spreading faster. So the abundance of this has created a reforestation of many areas that had been logged or clear cut in years past, and they're booming.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Carbon dioxide, you know, when you have more carbon dioxide, that actually leads to more agriculture and more food. You know, it's a good news story on the energy front. And the thing about this is that we're not using the resources we have. I mean, the latest line from the liberals, from the Obama administration, the Sierra Club, these green groups, and you're right, they're very fascistic, and they're also Stalinist when it comes to their policies. They want complete government control. Their new line is keep it in the ground. Keep it in the ground. So we have $50 trillion worth of resources, and we're supposed to keep it in the ground. I mean, can you imagine if Saudi Arabia had made that decision 40 years ago? Okay, we have more oil, you know, in the sands here than any other country.
You make a good
point. We're
going
to keep it in the ground.
You make a great point, which is this. We have more energy at our fingertips than any piece of real estate in the world.
That's
and
right.
We could do that in the lower 48. You throw Alaska into the mix, it's ridiculous how much energy we have. So we could excuse ourselves from the conversation in the Middle East and all of the complications and entanglements we have there pretty simply.
Yes.
That's number one. Number two, and I want you to think about this. We have to go to a break here, but I want to set this up so you can think about this, Steve. We're with Steve Moore from FreedomWorks. Couldn't it be possible, if America becomes a net exporter of energy, be it, you know, liquefied natural gas, oil, coal, whatever it may be, if we could export that to Europe so they wouldn't have to rely on Russia going forward, the amount of jobs and careers it would create would be incredible. The amount of wealth that would come to the United States would be incredible. Couldn't it be possible to emulate what Alaska did in the 1970s, which is create a permanent fund? If you want all of these social programs, free college, free food stamps, whatever it may be, you could supply money for that from energy. We'll talk about that when we come back on the Steve Gruber Show.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
All right, welcome back to it. For those of you that don't know, and which happens to be a lot of people, because I tell people this and they say, really, that's true? I said, yeah, it's true. Since 1973, when the Alaska pipeline ran from Prudhoe Bay south, the Alaskans created a thing called the Permanent Fund. And in Alaska, the Permanent Fund means if you are a resident of Alaska, you get a check from oil revenue every year. This year was about $1,600. So if you're a family of five, you get $1,600 times five. If you have more kids, well, you get a $1,600 check for every man, woman, and child living in Alaska as a resident. You can't just drive up there and grab the check and run. But the point that I'm making is, with the amount of energy we have in America and a national debt crowding $20 trillion, there is one solution in my mind that can turn the tide on that. That solution is energy. Be it natural gas, be it sweet crude oil, be it coal, whatever it may be. It is energy that can save America from its debt and possibly do a whole lot more. That's been my theory for a long time, Steve. Steve Moore with us from FreedomWorks. I think it's time to rebuild the American economy, and the number one portion of that is the energy sector, in my way of thinking.
Yeah, no, look, I agree with you, and I just did an analysis that found that, you know, if we were to drill for energy on, again, on federal lands, and I'm not talking about Yosemite or Yellowstone, I'm talking about non-environmentally sensitive land, we could raise, not only would we increase our GDP by at least one percentage point, and not only would we create hundreds of thousands, if not millions of new jobs, but we would also raise about $3 to $5 trillion in revenues for the government that could be used to balance the budget and even hopefully retire some of our $19 trillion national debt. So this is—it's almost as if we've got this gigantic treasure chest that's sitting right below us, and the liberals don't want to go and get it.
Well, here's the thing: you have things like a Gasland, a highly discredited. A highly discredited alleged documentary that shows, well, tap water is on fire and so forth. Tap water catches on fire because there's methane in the ground. Methane naturally occurs in the ground all over North America and around the world for that matter. So having your tap catch on fire means exactly nothing and has exactly nothing to do with fracking. But you have these alleged environmentalists like Bill Nye, the science guy, who has, well, no background in science whatsoever. Newsflash, he's not a science individual, but he's against fracking as well. So you have all these imbeciles running around that people actually listen to. It's mind-numbing.
Well, it really is. And when you mentioned the Alaska pipeline, which was a very controversial infrastructure project at the time, and it probably won't surprise you that the environmentalists wanted to block that. They didn't want to build the Keystone Pipeline because, remember, they said it would kill the elk and the moose and so on. None of that turned out to be true. And, you know, we did build that pipeline. It was one of the most important infrastructure projects in the 20th century for the United States.
In fact, let me jump in here. In 2014...
Let me just finish my point.
Go ahead.
You couldn't build the Alaska pipeline today.
No.
The environmentalists are so out of control, they would not allow it to be built, and that's why we can't buy the Keystone pipeline.
Right. Here's the fact. I drove from Fairbanks north across the Yukon River in the fall of 2014, along the entire drive of about 4 hours, however many, couple of hundred miles there, we drove alongside the Alaskan pipeline. It takes up about oh, what would be equivalent to one single lane of roadway. That's
yep.
it. They have not had a significant leakage in that pipeline since 1973. They have yep. helicopters that fly the entire length of the pipeline twice a day, every day. And the caribou, not elk and moose, by the way, the caribou calve next to the pipeline because, on average, it's 4 to 5 degrees warmer ambient
warmer,
temperature
yep. warmer,
to lay
yeah.
next to the pipeline. So that's where they go and have their babies.
Yep.
It's good for the wildlife.
It is. It is, and in fact, you know, but my point is that thank God we didn't listen to the environmentalists back 40 years ago, or we wouldn't have built that important project that helped us produce billions and billions of acres of barrels of oil. But we're facing the same constraints today, and if we get this right, I mean, this is so huge for the economy. I mean, I heard Hillary Clinton last night saying we're to rebuild the economy. How are you going to do that? Well, she said, I'm against coal, I'm against fracking, I'm against, you know, building pipelines. Those are all the things that are major building blocks to our economy. You know, the latest statistics show that our economy has grown by less than 1% over the last 6 months. We're not, the economy isn't growing. We need energy, tax reform, regulation reform, all those things, and we can get this economy really moving again. But without it, we're going to be stuck in a rut for the next 20 years.
We need careers for the next 50 or 100 years. Those careers can be found in energy. Because when you build an energy plant, you have the people that, well, those that build the pipeline, those that service the pipeline, those that take and drive the trucks and move the energy,
yep,
those
yep.
that take and transport the energy. And in my way of thinking, I think we're technologically advanced enough. We could build a pipeline all the way from North America under the ocean to Europe to deliver liquefied natural gas. That's how crazy I am. I think we could do such a thing.
I think we could. And by the way, think about if we do that, where does Europe get most of its energy from today?
Russia.
Russia. What a better way to stop the Russian threat and this, you know, lunatic Vladimir Putin than, you know, they're terrified of us, by the way.
That's
and
right.
When the environmentalists block our energy development in the United States, you know who cheerleads? The people at OPEC and Vladimir Putin. They're like, yeah, you go
well,
to it. They're probably funding the Sierra Club for all I know.
Well, they're funding a lot of those anti-fracking ads you see on TV. That's been shown
yep.
to be true several times. Steve, we have enough time left here for people to find out where they can find out more about your conversation. Give me a resource.
Well, I mean, I think FreedomWorks does a great job on the energy stuff. I have a book that's coming out next month called Fueling Freedom, about everything we've talked about, that the energy revolution is going to transform the American economy, but we have to elect people who want this to happen to protect American jobs and to make our economy boom again.
Steve Moore, great conversation. You're welcome here anytime.
Anytime. Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you. Have a great morning.
There you have it. It's the Steve Gruber Show on a Wednesday.
Good morning, America. How are you?
What's great about America?
Say, don't you know me?
So many things to consider. How about this for today? Monticello. Monticello, you've probably heard of it, but maybe you haven't. In 1769, Thomas Jefferson began construction of Monticello, a 43-room mansion on a stately 1,000-acre plantation he had just inherited. The mansion, which Jefferson designed himself, would take 40 years to complete. He used stone quarried from his own land and expensive glass imported from Europe. By the time the house was finished, Monticello was then and is now one of the most distinctive and influential architectural landmarks in the United States. It is spectacular. Indeed, in addition to his celebrated political accomplishments, Jefferson also emerged as one of the foremost architects of his day. His designs for Monticello and the University of Virginia are among the finest examples of classic American architecture of the 18th and early 19th centuries. Heavily influenced by Greek and Roman forms, Jefferson's designs embody the hopes of the generations of Americans who dreamed of recreating a new republic in the new world. Now, think about this. You talk about how gifted some of our founding fathers were. Think about this. Jefferson inherited the property in 1757 and named it Monticello, meaning little mountain in Italian. At the age of 25 in 1768, he began teaching himself architecture. This is how gifted this guy was that wrote the Declaration of Independence and played a critical role in creating the Constitution, he began to teach himself architecture. Why? So he could design the house. So he could design the house himself. It was heavily influenced by Andrea Palladio, which is Palladian architecture, which the U.S. Capitol also designed in Palladian architecture, although not by Thomas Jefferson. What's great about America? Monticello is great about America. Have a great Wednesday, my friends. I'm Steve Gruber. This is the Steve Gruber Show. We'll talk tomorrow. To fade into a bad dream and to steal